I have a dream.
One small step.
Oh, my, what do you say?
The wall must go.
China, Princess of Wales.
Crash into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
On this day, February the 16th in 1959 in Cuba, a change of regime that's lasted until the present.
Havana, often the mecca for gamblers, sees the jackpot payoff of a political long shot. Bearing 26th of July banners, joyous followers of Fidel Castro sweep triumphantly through the Cuban capital hours after their rebellion had toppled the regime of Fulgencio Batista.
His army of irregulars have taken over an island of 6.5 million. And now, the voice of Senor Castro, non-practicing lawyer, revolutionist by profession, who has often said, I am fighting for a democratic Cuba and an end to dictatorship. And soon, with diplomatic recognition received from the U.S. and other countries, Cuba can begin the big task of returning to normal.
On February the 16th, 1959, Fidel Castro was sworn in as Prime Minister of Cuba after leading a guerrilla campaign that forced right-wing dictator Fulgencio Batista into exile. Cuba's close neighbour, the United States, initially recognised the new Cuban dictator, but soon withdrew its support after Fidel Castro launched a programme of agrarian reform, nationalised US assets on the island, and declared a Marxist government. To explain further about how and why Fidel Castro managed to take control of Cuba 61 years ago and remain untoppled until his death in 2016, we're joined by Professor Adrian Hearn from the Department of Spanish and Latin American Studies at the University of Melbourne. Hello, how are you, Adrian?
Indira, I'm very well. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. Well, Fidel Castro has been born to a family that was wealthy. Take us back to where this revolutionary fervour started. How did he become radicalised?
Well, Indira, Fidel Castro studied law in his youth. And I think a combination of his experience studying and becoming sensitised to issues like injustice and inequality, combined with his own personal experience and observations as he looked around him in those years in Cuba, led to a growing dissatisfaction with the regime. And I think that it's that combination of study and experience which, you know, really motivated him to spearhead the formal opposition to that regime.
Well, tell us about this regime. What was it about them that he wanted to overthrow?
If you look back to, you know, the 1940s, 50s in Cuba, you see that the levels of inequality were really extreme. So, for instance, when Fidel Castro took power, only about 8% of Cuba's rural population had health services. And that was also defined along racial lines. So it was people of African descent, Afro-Cubans, who were the descendants of enslaved people who'd been brought over from West Africa that were still trapped in a kind of cycle of poverty. Those people who lived largely in the countryside after having grown up on sugar plantations and the agriculture projects of the colonial powers were extremely disadvantaged. And Fidel Castro saw those disadvantages. And I think those were the real kind of stimulant, I suppose, of his dissatisfaction with what was going on there.
Well, tell us about his first attempt to try to overthrow the Batista government in 1953.
Yeah, in 1953, by that point, Fidel Castro had gathered together like-minded people, more than 1,000 of them. They attacked the barracks of Moncada, which is near the city of Santiago de Cuba in the east of the country. Mm-hmm. They intended to dress up as kind of uniformed soldiers and attack and take control of the barracks. But it failed and most of them were killed. Fidel was captured and stood trial for that. And I think that further cemented, you know, his resolve that, you know, having survived that he was going to see this through. And so you could say that Moncada was in some ways a failure, because they didn't succeed in their goal. But on the other hand, it was the inspiration for a much wider group of people to see what he and his group were doing. And I mean, even to the present day, you know, you have musical groups such as, you know, a band called Moncada, which draw on this kind of legacy, almost a kind of mythologized story of this rebellion against injustice in Cuba.
And why did that first overthrow attempt fail? Was it because he was ill-prepared or because he hadn't galvanized a wide enough support base?
I think it's a bit of both. You know, the numbers that he had when they attacked were not sufficient. It was really, I think, a sort of overambitious plan to think. And in fact, some historians have looked at this and said it was never really intended to be an overthrow of the political system. It was supposed to put a line in the sand to say there is a formal rebellion underway here. And here we have a visible, obvious manifestation of that rebellion. And it functioned in that way. In that sense, it was a success. It drew people to the cause.
So after that first unsuccessful coup, he was found guilty and sentenced to 15 years in prison. What was prison life like for him?
Well, many of the prisoners were held in Santiago de Cuba. And I, you know, had the privilege of living in Santiago de Cuba for about a year and a half, going back 15 or so years. Mm-hmm. I went to visit some of these cells and learn about what their lives had been like after being captured. You know, the thing that's always struck me is the how that seems, that experience seems to have consolidated their resolve. So Fidel delivered a speech called "History Will Absolve Me," which speaks for itself. He was saying, in the long term, in the future, people are going to look back at this and they're going to see that this was the beginning of something big, and furthermore, that it was justified.
And as we know, prisons are often incubators for revolutionaries. Was it a good way for him to gather his forces and increase his support base?
Well, that's a good insight there that you allude to, because he, in prison, did start to consolidate and did start to draw more support from those around him. And this is the reason why he was released from prison. The government of the time realized that he was more dangerous in prison than he was being let out and exiled. So that's what they did.
You're listening to Indira and I Do. It's Weekend Nightlife, and we're talking to Adrian Hearn from the Department of Spanish and Latin American Studies at the University of Melbourne. So after he was released from prison, he went to Mexico with his brother Raul, joined forces with Ernesto Che Guevara, and then they came back to Cuba, and he was in power a few years later. That was an extraordinary quick turnaround. How did he manage to do that so quickly? How did he garner the support of the people?
Well, Fidel and his allies, including his brother Raul, who later became head of the military in Cuba, they employed a strategy of geographic stealth. They went up into the mountains in the east of Cuba to an area where they were inaccessible by the soldiers and the forces, and they would come down and conduct raids. And they gained a sort of fame over this time. They were known as the Bearded Revolutionaries of the mountains. And it was from that point in the Sierra Maestra Mountains in the east of Cuba, they conducted this sort of war room strategy to gradually take more and more control in the east of Cuba before advancing west towards Havana. And as they went, they gained speed. They picked up support because people essentially were familiar with the inequalities, the injustices, the daily evidence of oppression that the Batista regime exerted upon them. And for this reason, when by the time they got to Havana, they were really an unstoppable force.
And was it a bloody revolution? I mean, I understand they ordered the deaths of many Batista supporters.
Well, after Fidel took power, there was absolutely a period of looking to see who had been the sort of proponents and the supporters of Batista. And that's right, there were executions, there were interrogations, there were imprisonments. I think his objective at that point was to consolidate his position and to avoid any remnants of the former regime from hosting some sort of return. In some ways, that was successful. His strategy worked. But on the other hand, it wasn't long before many of those who fled to the United States then hosted an attempt to overthrow Cuba in 1961, to overthrow Fidel and retake power. It's famously known as the Bay of Pigs invasion.
That's right, the Bay of Pigs. And this is the fascinating thing, because Fidel used the injustices and the unfairnesses and the discrimination of the Batista era to attract people to his cause and promise democracy. But before the Bay of Pigs happened, had he delivered anything like the democracy he'd promised?
On this, you know, I often think of a colleague of mine in Cuba, Rafael Hernandez. He's a sociologist, but what he argues, and I think he's right to say this, is that through Cuban history, you've had very sort of polarized, conflicted dynamics throughout the society. And it's really difficult to try to consolidate a form of democratic governance in that environment. And so between 1959 and 1961, the Cuban government under Fidel Castro was playing the game of trying to cement itself in power. And they spoke a lot about the inequalities that had preceded them and what they were going to do about them. I wouldn't say that by 1961, anything like a democracy that we would recognize in the present day had emerged in Cuba. I think that was always the goal. But the way that they tried to move forward was with these sort of mass campaigns to try to get the public on board. So, for instance, the literacy campaign brought together about 700,000 people to try to go out and make people in the countryside literate, to teach them to read and write. Similarly, in building houses for people, you know, the public were invited and sometimes pressured to join these campaigns where they would essentially provide housing for themselves, to build their own housing. So it was through these mass campaigns that Fidel Castro saw the way to a more equitable situation. You know, again, we wouldn't look back and call that necessarily democratic, but that was the vision he had at that time.
And the US was initially supportive of Castro and what he wanted to achieve, but they turned against him. Why was that?
The relationship between Cuba and the United States, as you say, started off in a sort of ambiguous way. People weren't quite sure what Fidel Castro represented. But in 1960, that's when Eisenhower was in power. That's when the US government said, look, we're not happy with the way that you're talking and beginning to implement nationalizations of our companies that run the oil sector, that run the agriculture sector. And so it was in 1960 that Eisenhower started prohibiting import of Cuban goods. Then by July that year, the sugar, which Cuba had relied on to underpin its economy, the exports of sugar to the United States, the U.S. reduced the quota enormously to about 700,000 tons that year. And that's what really caused the Cubans to look at themselves and say, what are we going to do? You know, what are our options here? We cannot run our economy when the market that we've depended on for decades has cut us off. And it's at this point that the Soviets stepped in and said, hey, we'll buy it.
Yeah. And you were talking about those disaffected Cubans who were then supported by the US, and it led to the Bay of Pigs incident. Now, I was in Cuba a few weeks ago on a holiday and a bit of an adventure, and I actually got to swim in the Bay of Pigs. It was absolutely flat and tranquil. It was all that idealized Caribbean palm tree white sands that you imagine. And I couldn't imagine what it must have been like during that invasion. So take us back to that time.
Yeah, the Bay of Pigs happened, the invasion or the planned invasion and overthrow of the Cuban government happened in April 1961. And this was largely the exiles, the people who had left Cuba, most of them voluntarily, right? They had been landowners, they'd been people in upper middle class or upper class positions, and they felt that, you know, the future for them really lay in a change of government in Cuba. That's what they wanted to see, because many of their lands were confiscated. They were offered, by the way, it's an important footnote, that they were offered compensation for this, but many of them refused that compensation. Because had they accepted it, it would be almost like saying, well, we agree that, you know, we give you permission to annex these lands.
Right.
That, you know. So many of them went away to the United States, and they became influential in Miami, in New York, in Washington, D.C., allied themselves with the U.S. government, and set about invading Cuba to try and overthrow Fidel's government. Now, one of the things they didn't count on was that Fidel Castro and his movement were incredibly organized. You know, you think back to the Moncada strike in the early 50s, all of the time that passed in between, they had developed strategies. They were organized. They had a very disciplined group of allies and soldiers. And so they were prepared for anything like this. And even the population was armed. The Cuban population was armed to try and fight any possible invasion that might come. So when those people arrived, they had no chance. The Cubans were ready for them and outmaneuvered them and repelled them. And it was very humiliating for those who had tried to do this. They thought that with the backing of the CIA, they couldn't fail. I don't know if, Indira, in your free time, you might have watched this this movie that came out, I think, last year called The Irishman.
I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it has some interesting insights into this. One of the points that it shines a light on really is that the Italian mafia that had run many of the casinos and brothels and the underworld of Cuba prior to Fidel Castro's revolution really wanted to get back into Cuba. And so in that movie, they sort of show the perspective of these Italian gangsters that were really hoping that the Bay of Pigs would succeed. And I don't know how true it is, but in the movie, they sort of show that these Italian mobsters were providing equipment and facilitating the arming of Cuban exiles to undertake this invasion. It's a very interesting sort of insight into history.
It is, because one of the things that it isn't so well known is that mob connection with Cuba. We stayed at the Hotel Nacionale in Havana, and the wing we were in, all the big mob leaders at the time took over the hotel one weekend, and Frank Sinatra and Ava Gardner were all flown in to entertain them for the opening of the hotel. Eartha Kitt was there as well. And, you know, the mob had a huge stranglehold, a real hold in Havana at the time.
And this is part of the, you know, the logic and the rhetoric of the revolution. They've always said since the beginning that the main purpose was to eject corruption, to eject the resulting inequalities from Cuba, and to maintain a more equal system. Now, you know, we get into contentious waters here because there are many people who are on board with that idea. But there are many people who have looked back at history and said, well, especially since the fall of the Soviet Union and even leading up to it in the 1980s, that the inequalities in Cuba were beginning to grow again and that there was no opportunity for people to have jobs and to live a decent life. And so this is one of the reasons, I think, why Fidel Castro as a historical figure is so polarizing. You know, some people see the positives and the intentions, but on the other hand, they have to acknowledge that when the Soviet Union collapsed, Fidel revealed himself really as having relied too much on the Soviet bloc and not having developed Cuba in a sufficiently independent way to maintain people's livelihoods and ways of life.
This is Weekend Nightlife, and we're talking to Adrian Hearn from the Department of Spanish and Latin American Studies at the University of Melbourne about the legacy of Fidel Castro. So, as we know, and history has told us, after that invasion was successfully put down, the Russians moved in and placed their missiles around the island, and that very famous standoff between America and the USSR happened.
That's right, Indira. That was in 1962, where you have this, you know, growing tension between the Soviet Union and the United States becoming focused for a point in history right there in Cuba, off the southern coast of the United States. It's too close for comfort.
Mm.
You know, the idea of having nuclear missiles harbored in Cuba. I mean, it's just sort of a, you couldn't make this stuff up. It's, you know, it's just a remarkable phase of history.
What did Cuba do when there was this withdrawal of USSR support?
The Soviet Union collapsed, as you know, at the end of the 1980s and early 90s. By that time, Cuba had become thoroughly dependent on Soviet support. The basic deal was that Cuba would send sugar to the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union would send oil and other necessities back to Cuba, but at a highly subsidized price. So it wasn't by any stretch a sort of free or equal trade. There was massive government subsidy involved here, and hence dependence on the Soviet Union. So here, interestingly, enters China, because until that point, the Russians and the Chinese had been kind of vying for control of international communism. And this had led to major splits between the Chinese and the Russians, both of them saying that we know the best way to conduct international communism. So Cuba had to choose between China and the Soviet Union. It chose the Soviet Union, which was, I think, the logical thing to do. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, that then opened the way for Cuba and China to start developing their relationship. And I think there is some logic to the argument that Cuba has always depended on, for lack of a better term, a big brother. And so it was in the early 1990s that China came in to fill that role. So we sort of go from the US to the Soviet Union and then to China. And that remains the case now, that, you know, the Chinese government has been a major supporter of Cuba. But as the Soviet Union collapsed, everybody thought that the same would happen in Cuba. I mean, this began in Poland in Eastern Europe in 1988, 1989, as the Soviet Union could no longer maintain control in Eastern Europe. People looked at Cuba and they said, well, Fidel is going to go the same way. It's 1989, 1990. And one famous book by a sort of academic journalist, Andres Oppenheimer, came out. I think the title says it all. It was Castro's Final Hour. And that was the consensus for many people at the time, that this would be the end. Now, interestingly, if you also think, Indira, what's going on in 1989, 1990, that's right when Tiananmen Square happened.
Berlin Wall collapsing. Yeah, a lot of things going on.
Exactly. And so when Tiananmen Square happened, everybody in the world turned their back on China, except for Cuba. Cuba was one of the only countries that invited Chinese diplomats to come and visit Cuba to give speeches to try to start building up some sort of international alliance again. And that's never been forgotten in China. So the Chinese started assisting very quickly Cuba to maintain itself in that difficult time. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that without that Chinese support, Cuba would have had a much more, turbulent time maintaining the current government in 1989, 1990. It might have not survived. The government might not have survived. China played a key role there.
So looking back on the last 4 or 5 decades of Cuban history and all the promises and all the expectations that the people wanted after that Batista regime and putting all those hopes and dreams into Fidel Castro, what did he deliver?
Well, that's a big question. I think, you know, you would probably get different answers to that depending on who you ask. And I could canvas what some of those are, but perhaps rather than do that, I'll just tell you a short anecdote of the something I experienced the day that Fidel Castro died in 2016. So I was in Havana that day, and I was getting ready to host a group from Melbourne that was going to arrive and do some work in kind of environmental management, ecological sustainability, which Cuba has a very good record in. So I woke up that morning in the house that I always stay in with the family I always stay with, and I went down the stairs and I saw one of my neighbors, a woman of about 35 years old, was coming up the stairs in the other direction. And I'd known her for a long time. She was someone that had lived a difficult life. Her job was informal. She would set up a table and do people's nails as they came in and out of the building. Mm-hmm. She basically scraped by in her living. She didn't live in any way a sort of wealthy or even comfortable life. So I saw her coming the other way, and she said to me, "So did you hear?" And I said, "Hear what?" And she said, "Fidel Castro died." Now, I thought she was joking, because she was constantly joking. She had the best sense of humor of anyone I think I've ever met, despite her conditions, right? She had this sort of positivity to her. She said this, and I said, "Yeah, okay, Audie Alice, that's funny, okay. And all right, what are you up to today?" And she just was sort of silent and looked at me and said, "Fidel Castro died." And as she said it, her voice sort of faltered, and I could see she was fighting back tears. And when I saw that, I realized she's serious, but it set off this sort of process of reflection that led me then through the day of speaking with people. And the reflection was, if someone like Orialis, who's lived a really difficult lifestyle, you know, she hasn't had opportunities, if she can be crying about the death of Fidel Castro, how is it that she feels so much emotion? You know, given her predicament, shouldn't she be happy? So, Indira, to answer your question, I think what Fidel Castro delivered in Cuba in the end was a sense that's broadly shared that things, at least in terms of equality and racism, had gotten better. Now, there are many problems that still existed, but yet you could see it in the tears in people's eyes that they really felt that things had improved. And it was at that point that I realized that is the best answer to your question. People felt that he'd done something to improve the basic human rights of, you know, in relation to racism and economic opportunity, despite all of the problems that went along with it.
Adrian Hearn from the Department of Spanish and Latin American Studies at the University of Melbourne, thank you so much for taking us through the life and legacy of Fidel Castro.
Well, thanks, Indira. It's been a pleasure to be with you here, and I look forward to continuing the conversation another time.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.